This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack, but with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Watley on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Haystack Help Radio. Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, you've been hearing about Colorado Eye Consultants for several months now. For those of you that have not heard the reason why they are on with us, several months ago, I came here. Dr. Fish helped me out. Didn't even know really what cataracts were, but wanted to see if I had them because a lot of friends my age were having issues with cataracts and had cataract surgery and were very, very pleased with the result. And so I just wanted to see what was going on with my eyes and came over here, and sure enough, I had them. And Dr. Fish took great care of me, and the folks here took great care of me. I mean, the surgery center is right here, and we'll touch on a few of these things throughout the interview today. But just a total great experience from the first time I made an appointment till after the second eye was done, and follow-up appointments are all behind me now. But I'm telling you, I highly, highly, highly recommend Colorado Eye Consultants. And we've been visiting with the medical staff here over these last couple of months, and my privilege today to have Dr. Shane Now with us. So Dr. Now, nice to have you on.
Thank you. How are you? I'm doing really well.
Good,
thanks for having
me. Good, man. Hey, and you're a Colorado native. That's rare.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So your family's been around here quite a while?
Quite a while. Quite a long time. So my dad's family, they've been in the Colorado area for quite a while. They kind of came over from Nebraska, maybe the last couple of generations. But my mom's side of the family, my grandpa, he grew up in Plum Creek area.
Okay.
Just a little bit south of town here. And we have a lot of family in the area. I think I probably have about 10 cousins in the Littleton area.
Oh, really? Wow.
Everybody's kind of coming back to this area and having kids. And everyone went away for college, kind of came back. And everyone was drawn back to Littleton, Colorado. Everybody mm-hmm. wanted to keep coming back. And I think it speaks a lot to the beauty of the area.
Right.
And the things we have in Colorado are just so special.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, board certified. All right, tell us what that means.
Board certified means that once you've gone through medical school training, once you've gone through residency training, you take basically a series of very difficult exams to make sure that according to the standards set by your peers, that you have a very high level of expertise in your field.
Okay.
And to be board certified in ophthalmology means that you take a big written exam that's 8 hours long, and you have to make sure that you're answering questions. You have to answer enough of them correctly to ensure that you basically know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't end there. You also have an oral board exam where you actually have this in-person interview where another ophthalmologist who's already board certified and has been practicing for a number of years will kind of grill you and test you on pictures and cases and make sure that they feel like your level of competence is appropriate for treating folks in the community.
Right. So what made you, and you're a smart guy, you know, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing. So you could probably pick, you could have been an orthopedic guy. You know,
sure.
You could have done some different things.
Absolutely.
What made you pick this area?
That's a really good question. It's funny you mentioned orthopedics because, you know, I'm a big sports guy. You know, I played hockey, football. I played it all growing up. And I actually was fairly interested in doing orthopedic surgery when I was in medical school.
Hmm.
I love the surgery of orthopedic surgery. Lifestyle is pretty brutal. And the clinic, I found just to be a little bit boring. The clinic wasn't very exciting.
Right.
Ophthalmology, I fell in love with because the clinic, we can see everything right in front of me. Every patient who comes in, I have a microscope. I'm looking at your eyes. I'm not just hoping and guessing at what your diagnoses are. I'm actually looking at your eye and really diagnosing you based off of what I'm seeing under the microscope.
Mm-hmm.
And so I liked that firm feedback of what am I actually seeing? And I'm not just getting labs. I'm not just throwing you through MRIs and testing and a lot of advanced metrics and hoops to jump through. I really like the immediacy of the field.
Mm-hmm.
And what really did it was cataract surgery. As you have sort of been through,
right.
The first time I watched cataract surgery, even as somebody who is a second year in medical school, you don't have that much exposure to ophthalmology. Mm-hmm. And by the time you actually see cataract surgery, you know, it's just as amazing for the surgeon doing it or watching it as it is for the patient.
Right.
And to just see the beauty of it in the eye and the cornea, and to see this big yellow hazy cataract come out of the eye and then a nice crystal clear lens goes in, it just had me hooked right away.
Wow.
And then over time I did realize that, you know, when it comes to long-term gratification, short-term gratification, where was I as a physician? Where did I get the most meaning in my career? Mm-hmm. I realized that when I could get those short-term wins and I could get that immediate improvement in somebody's life, I liked that a lot.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to take care of somebody's diabetes. It's important to take care of blood pressure. And you see the effects of that 10 years, 20 years down the road. Mm-hmm. For me, I really enjoyed having that more immediate feedback where you could see that improvement in their lifestyle right away.
Right. And everybody's different. So this is just my personal deal. But when you say immediate, dude, it was immediate. I mean, yeah. I walked out here and I was like, first, and I told you before we even started recording that was it. And I've done quite a few orthopedic procedures in my life, you know, but I mean, man, that was the easiest thing. And I was honest. I mean, I had some anxiety coming in. I mean, it's my eye, you know, and I'm like just thinking of it. And then I shouldn't have Googled it to watch a video because then I'm seeing them slicing on. I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it was so easy.
Yeah. I always hesitate to say that because I know for the vast majority of patients, you know, I don't know the exact percentage, but in my mind, probably north of 90% are going to have that experience. Mm-hmm. I try not to promise patients like, hey, this is going to be the easiest thing
Everybody's
in your life. It's easier than going to the dentist. But for the vast majority of people, I hear that feedback over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I would tell patients that, you know, when you go in for cataract surgery, it is completely normal to be nervous.
Right.
You know, everybody's going to feel like, wow, you know, somebody's going to do surgery on my eye. Like my vision is everything. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I hunt. That's how I fish. That's how I drive. That's how I see my grandkids' faces.
Sure.
And it's a big deal to let somebody approach that sensory organ. And, you know, I would just say here at Colorado Eye, and I think most ophthalmologists would feel this way, you know, we take that privilege with a lot of seriousness. And, you know, when we are going to do surgery on somebody's eyes, the amount of work and the amount of other eyes from our staff members to the surgeon that are looking at every detail. What were the measurements of your eye preoperatively? Do you have dry eye? What other factors do we have? Do you have macular degeneration? What are the measurements? Do we like the measurements? Should we get more measurements? Let's repeat these measurements just to make sure we have a good result. You know, when we do have these algorithms where we're trying to predict what is that vision going to be afterwards, there is a lot of work that goes behind the scenes. Mm. And I think that one of the things that we do here at our practice is we don't take any shortcuts.
Right.
And we just have everybody looking at every detail. And I do think it makes a big difference.
Yeah.
But we take it very seriously too.
Sure.
And I know it is very easy to say, oh, you know, it's a 15-minute surgery, no big deal. And I know the experience tends to be very easy mm-hmm. for most patients. But yeah, I mean, we love what we do.
Yeah.
And we do hear that a lot though.
Sure, sure. Again, if you're just joining us, Dr. Shane Now is with us. It's Colorado Eye Consultants. Their phone number, 303-730-0404. If you've been thinking about cataract surgery, and we do talk a lot about that when the docs are with us, but I'm telling you, I would highly, highly, highly recommend them. Come over and see them. Get a good eye exam. Let them take a look. See where you are. And that, well, let me ask you this, because I'm going to finish up about you a little bit. Again, you could have probably gone to a lot of different practices, started your own, whatever you wanted to do. So what made you choose Colorado Eye Consultants to come be with?
It's a great question. You know, I did have a lot of options. And, so I did CU Boulder. I went to CU Boulder for undergrad. I went to medical school at CU Anschutz and then did residency for ophthalmology here at CU as well. So I did sort of the trifecta of keeping my training in-house. And that was by design. You know, I had some options to go other places, but, you know, I've been married, had a couple kids through the process. My family's here. So we tried our hardest to stay here. And luckily we were blessed and it worked out that way. But that being said, you know, it was a very easy decision to choose this practice. You know, at the university, there's a lot of really well-respected, great doctors there. And as I was coming up through training and I would talk to them about next steps, you know, hey, I love Colorado. This is where I want to be. You know, if you were going to go join a practice in the community, where would you go? And the practice name that kept coming up over and over again throughout all the doctors was, hey, you know, Dr. Fish, Colorado Eye Consultants, they're doing something right over there. They're ethical. They're not taking any shortcuts. It's not about the business. They're physician owned. And you know, obviously that's still the case and hopefully will always be the case.
Sure.
And that was the name that just kept coming up. And it just so happens that, you know, it's 10 minutes from where my childhood home, where I grew up.
Wow.
And I actually went to elementary school across the school over here.
You're kidding.
And it's just like, it's kind of amazing to see how, you know, life comes full circle and end up practicing just a couple of minutes away from where I did, you know, first grade through eighth grade.
Yeah, I actually had a surgeon that had retired from here in the area that I'd known for a while, and I called him, and he's the one who referred Dr. Fish. So if doctors are referring you, that's where they would go.
Yeah.
Man. You know,
I will say, I do feel like at our practice, we have a disproportionately high percentage of doctors as our patients. Mm-hmm. And that's just not something I saw in other areas of my training going through medicine. It's not that common to have that.
Right.
But that is definitely something that I've noticed.
Yeah. And, you know, in a lot of different practices, I deal with some people that do hearing aids, different things. A lot of those have gone corporate buyouts.
Yeah.
And man, the care tanked.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that every person that's been on the show with me has brought up.
Yeah.
That physician-owned means the world, because now, and like I said, I'm in that, I mean, time I made my first appointment, to people walking you back to come in here the first time, talking with you and visiting with you, made you feel, you know, special to be here. You know, just the care that was given, man, was awesome.
Gosh, so, we're glad to hear that. Yeah. We agree. I think that's the reason why we're trying our hardest to keep it that way as long as we possibly can, hopefully forever. And, you know, I think that we all as physicians see that. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to other physicians who are in those practice environments where it's corporate owned, you know, it's pretty obvious that it's not a particularly healthy environment for the physician, for the staff, and of course the most important, the patients. I think the end experience is just not quite there.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, now you do medical ophthalmology and cataract surgery. So the medical ophthalmology, I just wanted to touch on a little bit. Tell us some of the conditions and maybe even touch on a brief explanation of what they are, that other things you help folks with.
Absolutely. So in terms of surgery, the bread and butter is cataract surgery. In my practice, I also do a little bit of glaucoma surgery as well. So if you have glaucoma, you have cataracts, a lot of times we can partner those two surgeries up really well for a very nice result that helps control your eye pressure and gives you better vision in the process.
And it's common for some people to have both of those?
It's very common to have both. Yeah, glaucoma becomes very common as you age, and cataracts become quite common as you age.
Sure.
So they usually, not always, but a lot of times they do go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. You know, from a medical standpoint, yeah, I treat dry eye, glaucoma, macular degeneration is a really big one for me. Diabetic retinopathy is a really big one. And of course, there's a lot of the in-between. Uveitis, you could go on and on. So there's a lot of sneaky eye conditions. There's too many to list, but those are probably the big four core, I would say.
Mm-hmm. My sister had juvenile diabetes and had that at like 12 or 13 years old. Ended up passing away at 61. Just a PSA here. stay away from diabetes and do everything you can to stay away from that horrible disease. And what makes that, though, because you don't think about pancreas and things like that, then affecting eyesight.
How does that work? What is diabetic retinopathy or eye involvement of diabetes, and why do we care about it so much? You know, diabetes, there's a lot to that. So I think a lot of people know about diabetes. Hey, my sugar levels are too high. People have been talking about these GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic. It's everywhere in the news. The reason why diabetic retinopathy is so important is because obviously it can affect your vision in a very serious and very permanent way, and it can actually happen fairly quickly. It's not just with the eyes, though, believe it or not. When I start to see evidence of bleeding in the eye from diabetic retinopathy, that can also be a very strong indication that your kidneys are also suffering, because the vessel caliber in the eyes is very similar to the vessel caliber where you get damage in your kidneys. Mm. And so as a team, as a medical team, as an ophthalmologist, I usually will communicate with your primary care doctor on whether or not you have bleeding in your eye, and that can clue them in that, hey, we really should be evaluating these kidneys to make sure that our patient's not going to go into renal failure and need dialysis in a few years. And so I think, one, it clues us into the overall state of the body.
Right.
Number two, you know, just the blood vessel health in general, looking at the retina health, it's one of the few areas that I can really look at the architecture of your blood vessels and see how you're doing. I can diagnose people with high blood pressure, not uncommonly, when they come into my office for a dilated exam. Of course, we can help give you an idea of how bad the diabetic changes are in the back of the eye. The diabetic changes in the back of the eye, there's a huge spectrum. You know, you might have mild diabetic changes where you have no symptoms whatsoever. You just have little spots of bleeding in the back of the eye. Or you might have very severe vision changes where you get a red snow globe from bleeding in the back of the eye and you basically lose vision. Wow. There are even more severe consequences like retinal detachments that you can get. So there's a pretty large spectrum of disease that we see. We don't want to catch it when you're having a big bleed in the back of the eye. Mm-hmm. That requires a surgery to fix. We don't want to catch it when you're having a retinal detachment and your permanent vision is threatened. We want to catch it when you have the earliest signs of bleeding so we can course correct and communicate with your primary care doctor to make sure that we're addressing the root cause of the problem.
Right. Wow. What symptoms, I'm trying to think of a way to phrase this. If you say, hey, if your eyes or your vision, you ever have these few symptoms, man, get to a doctor. Guys especially, we think, I just saw a few flashes and it just happens every once in a while, so I'm not really concerned about it. What are a few things that you say, man, don't mess around with this. Get in here.
That's a really good question. Because my dad's the same way.
Yeah.
I'm probably
as old as your dad, so, you know.
Fair enough. Yeah. My dad, he's the same way. Getting him to go see a doctor is like pulling teeth.
Yeah,
And he's still that way, even though I'm a doctor, which I'll give him a hard time about later. But, I would say there's a few things you don't want to mess around with. Any sharp decrease in your vision that isn't just like a fluctuating, oh, it's clear, it's blurry, a little bit of fluctuation. Like, my vision is clearly more blurry than it used to be. Don't mess around. Just come in. It might be something really benign like dry eye. It could be something very serious like an eye stroke in the back of the eye. So even something as simple as a little bit of blurry vision, you don't really want to ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
There are some really obvious ones we don't like to ignore. Flashing lights, bunch of new floaters is a huge one. If you wake up one day and you have too many floaters to count, you really need to seek medical attention that day from an ophthalmologist. And that one's, pretty critical. Because floaters, flashing lights, these can be signs that your retina may have torn. And if you have a torn retina, we have a critical window where we can try to basically laser it before it becomes a retinal detachment. And then you're looking at a big surgery and potentially loss of vision in the eye.
Right.
So these are pretty critical symptoms that we need our patients to just know, hey, I'm having some issues. I need to go see the eye doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that are pretty important, especially as you start getting into macular degeneration age. In my mind, macular degeneration mostly inflicts people over 60. That is going to look like distortion in your vision, not just like a little bit of blurriness that you can blink away. If you're ever looking at a straight line and it starts to look bent or wavy, that's a red flag.
Okay.
You might have fluid in your retina. You might want to come and see us so we can get a scan and do a little bit of digging to see what's going on. Also, any smudge or missing area, we call that a scotoma, where you just can't see a spot. You have like a little blind spot in your vision. If you see anything even slightly similar to that, that's a really good reason to come in as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Again, if you just joined us, Dr. Shane now is with us. It's Colorado Eye Consultants. ColoradoEyeConsultants.com. You can check them out there. Their phone number, 303-730-0404. Do most people come in for cataract surgery? Are they trying to, what's their reason besides improve it? Is it to try to get rid of glasses? And then how many people need glasses still? I mean, I just wore contact in my left eye for small reading because hunting and things that I do, man, I didn't want to mess my long vision either. And so they did, I believe, for reading in my left eye and then left some kind of medium vision in my right. And, man, it's just been perfect, So everybody's different, I guess, in what their goals are, right?
Yeah. I would say that's exactly right. So with cataract surgery, and every clinic's going to be a little bit different. I think there are some clinics that, are probably getting a younger population coming through. They might have a slightly different goals. Our clinic here, I would say primarily it's my patients are having a hard time with their vision.
Mm-hmm.
And my general philosophy with cataract surgery is if you're not having a problem with your vision, I don't really want to do surgery on your eyes. I know when you say it out loud, it sounds kind of obvious and hopefully everybody feels the same way, but you might be surprised depending on where you end up. But the biggest thing for me is, are you truly having any visual symptoms that are affecting your quality of life? Now, this is where the subjective nature of it can really go a lot of different directions. I have some truck drivers where they're driving, you know, 60 hours plus a week, a lot of times at night. And if they even have a little bit of glare when they're driving, not only is it threatening to their life, but also to a lot of other lives. Sure. So our threshold for doing cataract surgery with glare at night is going to be a lot different than somebody who rarely goes out at night and they feel like they're doing fine. So as a cataract surgeon, I try to mirror the priorities and the philosophy of my patients. And if my patients are a little bit more aggressive and they're like, hey, I'm really having a problem, I can't go see my grandkids' baseball game because it's getting dark and I don't feel comfortable driving home, well, we can make a really serious case to do cataract surgery. Of course, we're going to go over the pros and the cons. We're going to make sure we're not doing anything unreasonable. But it really depends on the patient. Right. But I would say glare at nighttime is a big one. Mm-hmm. So if you're driving at night and those headlights are, starbursts are bad, glare is really bad, dim light in general, you're just not seeing well if you don't have a lot of light coming to the back of your eye. That could be driving. That could be going on an evening walk. That could just be walking in your hallways in your home without a bunch of lights on, and you're like, I can't really make it to the bathroom very easily right now. So there's a lot of different symptoms with cataracts, but dim light, glare, those are some really big ones. And then, of course, blurry vision. Where I usually see that setting in is, you know, I'm not seeing those road signs on the highway. I'm not tracking my golf ball very well. Hunting, I'm just not, I'm not like really getting in on my target quick very well like I'd like to. I just can't see it. Those are a lot of the things I'll hear from my patients coming in.
I'm always looking for my golf ball in the woods, you know, in the trees.
Absolutely. And then, of course, there are some, I like to call it bonuses to cataract surgery. Yes, it is really cool that we can get you out of glasses, and that's a great part of cataract surgery.
I haven't had, man, it's been great.
It's great. Yeah, we have so many cool options. You know, we have light adjustable lens, multifocal lenses.
That's where I was going next, so go ahead. Let's talk about
into
options.
There's so many cool options that can potentially get you out of glasses or at least limit your glasses prescription to a degree. But the really underpinning of what we're doing is just trying to make you functional. We're trying to make you a safer driver. We're trying to allow you to be a safer just person walking around at home to reduce fall risk. Mm-hmm. And to allow you to do the activities that you want to do in life. Now, when it comes to do you need to wear glasses, do you not need to wear glasses, it gets pretty complex. You're always going to want to have a surgical evaluation to get more specific advice that's custom to you. But the general idea is you have to think about things like astigmatism. Do you have any other pathology in the back of your eye that's going to limit your vision? Do you have double vision? There's a lot of things that go into it. But we do have a lot of really cool lens technologies that we just didn't have 20 years ago. Right. We have lenses that have rings in them. We call it multifocal lenses. They can give you distance and near. Not everybody's a good candidate for those lenses, but if you are a good candidate, they work very well. We have toric lenses to address astigmatism. We have this light adjustable lens, which we can sort of customize and change with light so you don't have to go back in for a second surgery. Right. We can just shine patterns of light at it to change the shape of it. So there's some pretty cool options that we just didn't have several years ago.
I mean, you came into this at a good time, man. Think about 20 years ago. And you, I'm sure you probably talked to some doctor 20 years ago. What did you do back then? Man, it was probably like, oh my God,
it's
really?
Come a long way. It's come a long way. And then I will talk to patients who their only experience with cataract surgery was, well, you know, I remember my dad or my grandpa had cataract surgery back in the 1980s and they put bean bags on his head and he had to stay in the hospital for a full day. And I'm like, oh wow, you know, it's a reminder that we've come a long way. People don't realize that when you come in for cataract surgery, you know, if your surgery is at 9, you show up at 8, you're gone by 10.
And I'm telling you, dude, I was like, you got to be kidding me. Man.
Exactly. And, you know, like I said earlier, you know, I don't want to downplay it too much. You know, it is, there's a lot of effort that goes into it. It is a serious surgery. Mm-hmm. It is your eye. We take it with full seriousness. But, you know, I think from a patient experience, there are a lot of misconceptions I think people have out there that, you know, I think they'd be pleasantly surprised when they go through the experience.
Sure. So kind of walk us through. They come in the first time. And that's just a full eye exam, right?
That's right.
To check out and just see what they're a candidate for.
Yes.
So is that your first, I mean, is that your million-dollar question in how much is this affecting your lifestyle right now before you get into talking about surgery?
I would say yes. Before I really get into talking about surgery, I want to make sure that, you know, if I do cataract surgery for this patient in front of me, they're going to end up in a better spot than where I'm finding them right now. Mm-hmm. There are patients who will come in, hoping that cataracts are their problem, hoping that cataract surgery will fix their problem, and we discover that, oh, you know, your problem actually is macular degeneration, uh-huh. or your problem is severe dry eye, and we have to address that. So the first thing is to make sure that, you know, we have the right diagnosis, mm-hmm. and that I actually feel like this is going to improve your life. And there's plenty of times where I'll tell patients like, hey, you know, your cataracts, they're there, you know, they're getting there. They're moderate. I don't think you're going to have this massive improvement in your vision, or maybe we could get you out of glasses. But we don't globally recommend cataract surgery to anyone with the first sign of cataracts.
Right.
We like to make sure that, yep, these cataracts are actually causing you to have some issues. Mm-hmm. And that's reflected in the symptoms that you're explaining to me.
Right. And, you know, it wasn't only just vision, just seeing and reading and things, but man, colors.
Colors, yeah.
I mean, it's like getting a brand new colored TV in your eye, you know?
I know. That's one of my favorite things. I think that was one of the most surprising parts about being a cataract surgeon early on, was I was always looking for that 2020 number. Like, I got to hit the 2020. Show me that 2020. But the more you listen to patients, some of the things that will blow them away the most is the color difference. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt like I was just looking through a dirty yellow window.
Right.
And it was just, everything had a sienna tint to it, or like a haze. And now, after cataract surgery, they're like, you know, I can actually see blues again.
Right.
Whites are actually white. You know, the amount of times a patient has come in and told me, you know, I had to repaint my kitchen after cataract surgery. It's probably like 2 out of 10 patients who tell me there was a major painting issue in their house that they didn't realize.
Well, it's such a, for most people, I guess it's a slow progression.
It is.
So, you know, we don't even really know what we don't know until you do it. Then you're like, you got to be kidding me.
It's amazing, right?
I mean,
yeah.
Because when you do the first eye, then you're seeing that, you know, you block the eye you haven't done yet. I'm like, that blue is totally different, or that color is totally different.
That's exactly right. And that is actually one of the challenges we have as cataract surgeons. Sometimes we see folks who have pretty bad cataracts, and they're a little hesitant. They're like, you know, doctor, no, I'm just not having a big problem. I can kind of get around. I can kind of see what I need to see. Mm-hmm. Eye surgery seems really invasive to me. And in my mind, I'm thinking, if you only knew.
Yeah.
You know, the other side is so much more clear. You know, the colors are going to be so much better. But, you know, as a surgeon, you try to thread that needle of respecting their philosophy.
Sure.
You know, how aggressive do they really want to be? You know, are they 90? Are they 60? That factors into a lot of my decision making. But yeah, that can actually give me a lot of trouble is, you know, when you see these very incremental changes for the worse, people don't notice it. I always explain to my patients, it's kind of like if you don't see your grandkids every day, you see them, let's just say once a year, you see them and you're like, wow, they're huge. They don't even look the same.
Right, right.
But for the parents, you just don't see that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I have 3 little kids, so I see that example every day in my life.
Yeah, great. Well, man, we appreciate your time today. It's great to sit down with you and learn a little bit about you. And folks, look, again, they've got some great docs here, but hey, give Dr. Shane now a call, 303-730-0404, and they'll take great care of you here at Colorado Eye Consultants. Check them out, ColoradoEyeConsultants.com. So thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Haystack Help Radio. We got to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more right after this.
How much do you need to lower your monthly mortgage payment? $200, $300, $400 or more? As rates decline, take AIM, Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Over 24 years of saving Coloradans money. Low rates, lower payments, less costs. What makes us different is we listen. As an independent mortgage broker, we shop the top lenders to save you the most. Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Want to purchase your next home? You can't qualify unless you sell your current home? Let us show you how to get the down payment out of your current home, qualify for the new one, and then sell yours for the most. Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. So you want to buy a home. Let us show you loans that can save you money, low down payment, first-time home buyer specials, fixed rates in the fours with buy-downs. Call for details, 720-895-0500, or apply now at aimortgage.net. That's Affordable Interest Mortgage, where it's all about you. Regulated by DORA, NMLS, 217-147, Equal Credit Lender.
Riding an e-bike will make you feel like a kid again. Just try it. Hi, I'm Randy Kranzi, founder of eBike of Colorado. E-bikes are a fun way to ride around town. Pedal Assist technology flattens the steepest hills. We have 14 major brands to choose from, and our expert staff will find you the perfect bike. Come take a free test ride at eBike of Colorado in downtown Louisville next to the historic grain elevator. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Learn more at ebikeofcolorado.com. Just try it.
You're listening to 560 KLZ, your home station.
Welcome to Your Health Matters, sponsored by Integrated Health Systems. Traditional medicine has left you frustrated. You've seen doctor after doctor searching for answers, only to feel more confused than ever. Chiropractic neurologist Dr. Shane Stedman, along with his team at Integrated Health Systems, does the detective work you need to identify causes, not just treat your symptoms. Using a team approach to combine functional medicine with neurology, Integrated Health Systems spends the necessary time with each client to find out what's really going on. Thanks to Dr. Stedman and his team, many clients who struggle with debilitating health issues have finally found relief. Now, Haystack Help Radio proudly presents Your Health Matters.
And we'd like to welcome you to Your Health Matters. As mentioned, brought to you by Integrated Health Systems. Hey, always a free initial consult. 303-781-5617 is the number. Glad to have Dr. Perry Maynard join us once again. Dr. Maynard, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm good. How was your weekend?
It was good. It was good. Dr. Stedman and I went to a concert together on Friday, which was nice. It was a beautiful evening. And then Saturday did a deep clean of my house, which was much needed, you know, like clean, like actually like steam cleaning the couch, like kind of that stuff.
Really clean. Yeah.
And and it was one of those things I didn't necessarily want to, but when I got home, my wife was already going to town, so I had to kind of just join in.
I know. Yeah. Well, man, we appreciate
you. It was a good weekend.
Yeah, good deal. And appreciate you jumping on here with us a few minutes today. You know, I was kind of thinking about before you came on the show and even just listening to the introduction, which we've heard hundreds of times over the years we've been doing this show, but I'm not quite sure there's another clinic in town that does as much crossover work as you guys do. And by that, I just mean all the different, you know, conditions, I guess I'll just call it that, that you guys can help people with. I mean, it is quite extensive, isn't it?
It is, it is. And I think it's because, you know, as you work with some more and more of these complex cases, I think it's important to be specialized. But even with that, it's so hard to disconnect the different systems of the body. You know, I think we talk about this all the time. You know, you have the GI doctor working on, you know, stomach and gut issues, but they don't communicate to the neurologist, right? And the neurologist doesn't communicate to the cardiologist. And we often see so much crossover with conditions that affect the brain, that then affects the heart, the stomach. And so individuals end up having, you know, six different providers and none of them know what's going on or none of them are communicating. So,
right,
you know, we've realized is like, hey, yeah, we have our specialty, but we have to also know a little bit about a lot, right? And that doesn't mean we're necessarily an expert on everything, but knowing a little bit about a lot helps you to really be able to serve the patient versus, you know, like I see every day, I had a patient today, and this is not a knock, but it's just the system. You know, it had a history of like MIs and some cardiac issues. So, you know, I referred out for that to be assessed. And it's funny, they want people to refer out and do this, do that. And my patient shows up and the cardiologist is just kind of like, well, why are you here? Well, you know what I mean? It's just like the poor patient, you know, ends up wasting, you know, an hour of her time and nothing happens. And, you know, it's just like, the lack of, I feel like, effort that is really put into, you know, these chronic health patients, I think, by the system, you know, is another reason why, right? Because no one seems to pay attention of the connection to all these things.
Right. Do you use the term chronic quite a bit on maybe not a day-to-day basis, but weekly basis, where you run into someone where it is termed a chronic illness or condition?
For sure. And I try not to use that term a ton because I think from a, you know, a psychological standpoint isn't necessarily great with patients. But yeah,
sure.
Most of the patients we see are, you know, like the girl I had before this phone call, you know, she's 22 and she's been struggling with things since I think she was like 8 years old. You know, some of these issues of heat intolerance, fainting, dizziness, fatigue has been kind of all around. So, you know, that is a majority of our patients, you know, whether they've been suffering for, you know, a few months, and usually most things are categorized as chronic past 3 months. So, yeah, we're seeing people well beyond that 3 month window.
All right. Again, Dr. Perry Maynard is with us from Integrated Health Systems. All right, today we're going to talk about something, and I'm sure we've probably done this over the years, but it's been a while if we have. We're going to talk a little bit about autoimmune disease and brain health. And Dr. Maynard does a lot of great work on the brain side of things as well as the autoimmune area. So how much do you guys see this there at the clinic?
Quite a bit all the time. I think, you know, we see autoimmune conditions quite a bit. I think what we see, honestly, a lot is these kind of like gray area patients where it feels very autoimmune. Some of the testing is coming back positive, but it doesn't quite meet the criteria to get a formal diagnosis, which we can chat about. I feel like the criteria a lot of times for these conditions wait until it is way too late. You know, so we're seeing patients that are fatigued, they're tired, they have joint pain, they have some of the positive markers for autoimmunity, but they also don't have a few other pieces. And so they go to rheumatology, they go to immunology, and they are told, well, healthy people can have these lab markers as well. And, you know, my response is always like, yeah, but what about your symptoms? Every symptom you have meets the criteria for this autoimmune condition, and you have maybe half the stuff that is positive, it kind of meets it, and they're just kind of ignored. So, I mean, we definitely see outright autoimmune that has been diagnosed, but like I said, we see a lot of this gray area, and they end up in our office because traditional healthcare doesn't have anything for them, nor do they even want to see them.
Yeah.
You know, I see patients, once again, turned away by multiple rheumatologists, and it's pretty much usually because it's not bad enough, right? Like, so when we look at, like, how do you diagnose an autoimmune condition, there's really multiple criteria, right? There's symptoms. So let's take something like, you know, lupus or RA, like a rheumatological condition. It's symptoms, right? So is it, you know, we'll take, for example, because I've seen a lot of this lately, something like Sjogren's, which attacks a lot of the mucous membranes and glands within the body. So the symptoms may be dry eyes, dry mouth, vaginal dryness, you know, and GI symptoms, things like this, right? So symptoms. And then there is usually certain laboratory testing. So for Sjogren's, usually you see a positive ANA. And then underneath that, you see some other antibodies that should be positive as well, but like we'll talk about, they aren't always positive. And then usually you need signs of tissue destruction. So you need evidence that the said tissue is being destroyed. So like in Hashimoto's thyroid autoimmunity, you need signs that the thyroid is being destroyed. So you need symptoms, positive lab markers, and signs of tissue destruction. The problem is we see a lot of people who maybe don't have visual signs of tissue destruction, but they have positive antibody testing, and they have symptoms, right? And this is where, once again, traditional medicine will say, well, you know, sorry, you don't fit the bill. You know, come back maybe a decade later when it's really bad, in essence, right? And we've been seeing that quite a bit of patients that kind of, you know, and there's some interesting stuff I think you're seeing with COVID.
Right.
I think COVID is causing some things that we don't fully understand and doesn't fit what medicine has set as diagnosis from decades ago. And I think that's part of the problem. And so we're still trying to use these diagnoses from before COVID. But now since COVID, we're having all these individuals that look and smell just like autoimmune, but they don't quite fit the bill. You know, I'd say those are kind of the patients we tend to see.
Right. So when we talk about the autoimmune conditions affecting the brain and nervous systems, I don't know if the right way to ask is how can the autoimmune system conditions affect the brain and nervous system, or why does it do that? So whichever direction you'd like to take that.
Yeah, I think first we can kind of chat about, you know, what is autoimmunity? How does it happen? I think, yeah, and then how can it morph into the brain? So really, autoimmunity, you can hear it kind of in its name itself, but in essence, it is the immune system attacking itself, right? So in essence, right, all the cells in our body are made up of, you know, have different protein sequences, and the way the immune system works is, you know, think of it no different than like police force, right? They're going around, they're looking for bad guys, and, you know, let's say you got police in a shooting or something like that, and you need to be able to tell what are innocent bystanders and what is the enemy. And the healthier of an immune system we have, we can identify bad guys and we can make sure that we don't attack innocent bystanders, right? That is a simple way to think of autoimmunity. And there's different theories of why we think this may happen. One is central aspects in our immune system. So our immune system should be able to regulate for rogue T and B cells. So just like if we go back to, you know, the police reference, or let's say military reference, right? There's always kind of bad apples.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a hot topic these days, right? And hopefully those are weeded out, right? So hopefully when we have people that enter, you know, you may have someone who's maybe more violent or this or that, and we have to make sure that they play by the rules in essence, right? And so our immune system should be regulating immune cells and getting rid of hyperreactive T and B cells. So that is one of the proposed mechanisms that can kind of go awry. This other piece is what's called like the bystander effect. And this is where, say you get an infection, let's take COVID, okay? And let's say that virus looks very similar to self tissue. So an example would be mono or Epstein-Barr virus. So it can have what is called molecular mimicry or cross-reactivity with other tissues of the body. One specifically is the thyroid. And so when your immune system goes to attack that virus, it says, well, you know, that thyroid tissue kind of looks like the virus. Let's just make antibodies and attack that as well. So this is what is called kind of molecular mimicry, but also the bystander effect, where when you go to attack one tissue, you affect the other one as well, right? And so we know with COVID, there's some literature showing, I think it's upwards of like, it can cross-react with like 20 plus different bodily tissues. So that means that the COVID infection itself can have a similar molecular structure to over 20 different human tissues, right? Everything from thyroid to neurological to joint, all those different things, right? And this is really where you see the development of autoimmune disease.
Right.
So it can happen from an infection, an injury, a stressful event. There's different genetic predispositions. But ultimately, a lot of times, right, it happens in the body. And then we should have a blood-brain barrier. So we should have a system that keeps the outside immune system away from our central nervous system or our brain. And this is really the blood-brain barrier. But with autoimmune disease in the body, right, so maybe we have Hashimoto's, or maybe we have rheumatoid arthritis, this over time will lead to inflammation, which can lead to breakdown in that blood-brain barrier, which then can lead to those rogue immune cells moving into the brain. And this is where we might start to see things like brain fog, cognitive issues, or even the development of autoimmune diseases in the central nervous system. These could be things like MS, and other conditions that people may be aware of. But in essence, you can have an immune issue that may start in the body. We get breakdown of that blood-brain barrier, or that breakdown of that blood-brain barrier allows inflammation, toxins, viral infections into the brain, and then we start getting reactivity. And then, you know, once we get breakdown, that's when things can get really difficult, and you can see a whole myriad of different symptoms.
Right. So does the word inflammation, we use that just about every show in some way, does that fall into the autoimmune, under that autoimmune umbrella, or is that just a separate thing you always talk about with people, inflammation?
Yeah, I mean both. It can. I mean, you can have inflammation and not have autoimmune disease. If you have an autoimmune disease, there is inflammation, right? Because autoimmune disease is, once again, it's waging war against your own tissue, right? So they are notorious for having chronic inflammation, right? And that's where you see breakdown of tissue. So in Hashimoto's, the immune system is causing inflammation and attacking the thyroid gland. In multiple sclerosis, the immune system is attacking the myelin sheath of nerves. In RA, right, we're attacking the synovial fluid within joints, right? And so you start to get inflammation and breakdown in joints, and so on and so forth. So there is always inflammation in autoimmunity, but inflammation doesn't always mean that there is autoimmunity. But we do know that there is a connection between chronic inflammation and increasing your risk for autoimmunity. Mm-hmm. Anytime we have an imbalance in the immune system where we're in more of a pro-inflammatory state, this is one of the proposed theoretical mechanisms that can cause autoimmunity.
Wow. Dr. Perry Maynard is with us. Once again, their number for a free initial consult is 303-781-5617. So do these connect anyway? When you talk about, you know, gut health, immune system, brain health, do some people maybe just have one of those, but yet you've seen people that maybe a touch of all three of those? And then if so, man, how do you start? You can't correct everything in a visit. So, I mean, how do you go about figuring out, you know, where the patient wants to start and maybe correcting some of these?
No, that's a great question. And so going back to, yeah, there's a huge connection between the gut, the immune system. I mean, that's where I think having a thorough evaluation to kind of figure out what is going on. I mean, anytime we look at autoimmunity, there's certain things we want to look at. So we want to first explore like triggers. So that's where we explore viral infections, bacterial infections, you know, exposure to toxic chemicals, right? Is that something like mold exposure or pesticides, herbicide, right? The list can go on and on, you know, and then once again, we'll do specific labs looking at what is kind of going on with your immune system. So once again, like I mentioned, every autoimmunity might be very different. And that's way we may kind of tailor things. I mean, there is always kind of low-hanging fruit that we start with, right? So we always try to kind of start with what we can control, right? So a lot of dietary interventions, optimizing things like sleep, exploring supplements or different medications that may need to be used. I mean, pretty much everything up into the point of things like immune-modulating drugs, right? And some patients that come see us may already be on immune-modulating drugs, or like I mentioned before, traditional medicine doesn't want anything to do with them, so we kind of have to do everything up into that point. So a lot of times, once again, we start with what we can control. You know, it's not necessarily sexy, but what we're eating every day, because going back to molecular mimicry, foods, right, dietary proteins can actually cross-react. So, you know, gluten is a prime example. You know, we know gluten has kind of been, you know, demonized over the years. And I think for some people, it can be a real issue. So going back to things like Hashimoto's, we know that a lot of patients with thyroid autoimmunity will also have molecular mimicry with things like gluten and dairy. So that's where a lot of times we're looking for dietary antigens. One, it's easy to control for, right? We can control our diet. Two, it's relatively easy to test. And once again, it's something we're getting exposed to every day, yeah. Right? Like, you know, yeah, maybe we're getting exposed to mental stressors every day, but we're eating every single day. And so that is something we start with heavily, is what is in patients' environments and how can we manipulate and change that?
Right. So what symptoms might suggest that someone's neurological problems have a touch, maybe an autoimmune component?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think, right, it can be all sorts of symptoms. It can be brain fog. It can be chronic pain. It can be fatigue, numbness, tingling. Like, there can be a bunch of different symptoms. I would say one of the patterns you see very often in autoimmunity, once again, is it's been around for a while. Yeah. Nothing has really helped it. And one of the biggest things is, like, it can come and go. So it can kind of like wax and wane, right? When we look at autoimmunity and flares, this is something, you know, that happens quite a bit, is we can get changes in the immune system where we kind of get expansion and shrinking of immune cells. And this is where sometimes you can see people may go through periods where they're like, I feel pretty good. And then once a year, I kind of like fall apart, right? Or every few months I fall apart, or, you know, when the weather changes, different things like that. So a lot of times when I'm seeing patients where it's been around for a long period of time and symptoms kind of come and go, and it kind of fits kind of like that flare pattern, right? Where things will put them into a flare and then it may resolve. That a lot of times is making me think, is there some sort of autoimmune condition? And then once again, like, they've tried a bunch of things and nothing has really helped, mm-hmm. right? That's where we want to start looking under the surface of, especially if they haven't done anything towards autoimmunity, is to really start exploring, could that be a cause?
Right. Last 5 or 6 minutes here, so let's get into maybe some, you know, you come in, you kind of think, hey, there is some autoimmune things going along with this. What's your typical testing route there? I assume it would start with some good blood work.
For sure, yeah. So blood work is a part of it. So, I mean, like I mentioned before, always a really good detailed history. So, you know, if we just go back to a lot of the patients I've been seeing recently are patients with autonomic symptoms. So these are things like heat intolerance, temperature regulation, fainting, issues with sweating, and then dry eyes and dry mouth. So these patients sound very much like they have Sjogren's, but a lot of them go to rheumatology and, you know, don't get the diagnosis. So like in those patients, once again, we're doing a lot of autonomic testing. So we're looking at blood pressure, heart rate, how well they regulate that. We're looking at sweat testing, how well can they sweat, how well can they thermoregulate. This is where we're a lot of times we're using that punch biopsy that you and I have discussed before to mm-hmm. look at, do we see signs of small fiber neuropathy, right? So we're exploring all these other things that can come because there's some interesting literature showing that some of the early signs of Sjogren's can actually be autonomic dysfunction. So you can have autonomic dysfunction before you start popping positive for antibodies. And I think people are ignoring this quite a bit. You know, and I think we're catching a lot of these cases. And then, like you said, lab work. So a lot of times we're looking at, you know, basic lab work, but we're also looking at inflammation. We're looking at antibodies. So depending on what autoimmune condition we're concerned about, we're testing for specific antibodies. Sometimes we can do even more specific immune profiling testing where we can look at T and B cells, and we can look at, you know, the ratios of different T cells. For example, we have different T helper cells. So we have TH1, TH2, TH3, so on and so forth. We have a variety of different cells, and that can kind of give us the kind of the state of the immune system. Like I mentioned, like, do we have a higher ratio of pro-inflammatory immune cells? Do we have a higher amount of regulatory T cells? So we'll look at profiling of the immune system. And then sometimes we'll once again start looking for triggers. So looking for food triggers, infectious triggers, all those different things. So we get an idea of like, what are the triggers? Mm-hmm. What kind of autoimmune disease are we dealing with? And then, you know, what does their immune system look like? Do they need more support and regulation? Do they have more signs of, you know, TH2 or TH1 dominance, which can kind of change treatment strategies and how you support the patient? So it's pretty thorough, but it's different for every person. You know, I just give that example because I've been seeing a lot of these kind of Sjogren-esque patients where, once again, they've been to rheumatology, they've been to immunology and sent away. And when you really look at their case, it looks like a really early on case. But once again, no one really pays attention until there's really clear signs of tissue destruction, which I understand because their treatments are, right, immune modulating drugs, right? So like, I do get it to a certain extent where they don't want to expose people to drugs that can be dangerous and have really bad side effects if they don't have to. But at the same token, to send a patient off with nothing is wild. You know, it's kind of like, good luck. Hopefully this doesn't turn into something worse. And if it does, come back. And that's where we're trying to say, hey, what can we do to either improve quality of life? Maybe can we delay the time until this becomes really bad? Like, trying to do as much as we can. Once again, I think doing some of these interventions, they're very low risk, very low side effect. And that's why a lot of times we start with them. You know, we're not doing, you know, stuff, a lot of stuff with medications, but approaching more lifestyle. Once again, I don't think anyone is harmed by working on sleep, cleaning up diet, helping to regulate stress, and support different aspects of their body, right? So I don't think those things hurt, mm-hmm. and that's why a lot of times we start early with those kind of behaviors.
And what's nice is all those things you just mentioned right there, you can do right there in an integrated health system. That's what makes it really cool.
100%. Yeah, and the nice thing is, too, is we have Sharon and we have medical providers that if medications are needed, right, we have the more traditional side in office as well, so we can kind of come at it from both angles.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, last question here, but it's really sad because I would assume, and you kind of just said this, but most people have probably been suffering this for quite a while. I'm sure it's rare if somebody goes, oh, I just started feeling this last Thursday. Most people have been suffering this for years, haven't they?
Yeah, for sure. And they don't come to us first, right? They go to their PCP. Their PCP sends them to a bunch of places. Those specialists don't want to see them. And then they end up seeing us years later.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I think if they saw us sooner, right, we might be able to move the needle and advocate a little bit quicker.
Yeah. So, folks, hey, if you've kind of accepted a way of life, just saying, hey, I've never been able to find help, please, please call. It's a free initial consult, 303-781-5617. Let them know you heard Dr. Maynard here on Your Health Matters. And, hey, maybe you can get on a road to better health with the team at Integrated Health Systems. So, Dr. Maynard, always appreciate your time, and I'm sure I'll see you soon, sir.
Thanks so much, Scott.
All right, thank you. That's Dr. Perry Maynard, Integrated Health Systems, integratedhealthdenver.com. Thanks for being with us today for Your Health Matters.
Call Integrated Health Systems now for a free consultation. 303-781-5617. That's 303-781-5617. To book your consultation online, visit integratedhealthdenver.com. Thank you for listening to Your Health Matters. Be sure to join Dr. Shane Steadman live every Monday at 12:30 p.m. on KLZ 560.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.